Hi, today is April 23, 2023. I'm Todd Agassawar. I'm a good friend of good Dr. John Westfall. And this is Movies Podcast 457. That was kind of hard to say. Not sure why. Anyway, first thing I wanted to note is after months and months and months of thinking about it and deciding that a certain social media site starts with a T and ends with an R, it's become a dumpster fire, or a larger dumpster fire, I haven't abandoned it. I still like to go look. You know, like how you can't help but stare at a car crash?
Ah, yes.
And created a Mastodon account. So I am over there. John, have you tried Mastodon yet?
Years ago. We had, I forget who originally brought up Mastodon on the show, probably, 5 years ago now.
Oh, is that long?
Quite a while ago. And,
yeah.
We heard about it, and at that time, I looked into it, and I wasn't getting a lot of value out of that social media network they keep talking about.
Yeah.
Most of my following on social media has always been on Facebook, and so that's where actual people are that I like to keep up with.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at it and I thought about it and ultimately decided, I think I might have created an account and then used it for like 5 minutes and got rid of it. So I'm still of the same opinion because I still don't find that other social media network that's the dumpster fire to be all that useful, even when it wasn't a dumpster fire. So
yeah. You know, and I never was a social butterfly on Twitter, but I did find it useful for people who I don't actually know in person, but whose information I found valuable or entertaining or both. And so I've noticed that several of them have moved over to, maybe not moved is too strong a word, have created a presence on Mastodon. And so I have created mine yesterday just to follow them, really. Not so much to interact, but to read what they're saying.
Is Mobile Views 457. We have talked about Mastodon with Ryan Ozawa on Mobile Views 290.
Wow.
That was March of 2019.
Wow, that was a while back.
That was a little while.
Yeah, I should note, Ryan has a very nice YouTube video, a kind of an intro to Mastodon for folks who might be interested. You can search for him. If it's like everywhere else he is, his handle is probably Hawaii, Hawaii. If not, search for Ryan Ozawa, Ozawa, and you can probably find his YouTube channel. He's very active, so you can just search for Ryan Ozawa Mastodon. I'll probably have a search result for that. But anyway, yeah, so I joined. The only person, I think we have one of our MVP friends, Darren. So Darren is on there, and that's about it so far. I mean, people I actually know, you know, like communicate with. Two ways. But anyway, I'm willing to give it a try because, like I said, it's just it's very unpleasant on Twitter right now.
Very useless. And getting more and more useless all the time, which is the weird thing about it. It was that Twitter was a good place to see, you know, I think something might be happening. What are they saying on Twitter about it? And now I mostly think, well, I think something is happening. Let me go check Reddit. Reddit has become kind of the new, and plus you can check multiple subreddits and see if, you know, certain groups are talking more about something than others. So, yeah, I just don't see a lot of value in Twitter anymore. And who knows? This could be one extremely elaborate game of 4D chess, or it could just be a dumpster fire that's a dumpster fire.
I think it's a huge dumpster fire now. It's like, you know, one of those giant... Gosh, I figure we're somewhere in the U.S. I think it was in the Southeast, maybe. There was literally a place where a lot of tires had been, you know, dumped on purpose.
Yep.
Right? And the tires caught, rubber catches fire, for people who don't know. And it's not good when it does because it's really stinky. And the tires caught fire and they couldn't put it out for years.
Well, just like the coal fire under Centralia, Pennsylvania, that's been burning since the 60s.
Yeah.
And it's still... or unfortunately, like Murphy the Dragon at Disneyland, which caught fire last night during Fantasmic.
Oh, I didn't hear about that.
Oh yeah, there's some interesting video.
On
social media platforms, including Twitter, Murphy going up in flames more so than he should.
That is right. Unintentional flames, not caused by Murphy himself.
Well, yes. His flames apparently came out of his mouth and spread to his head and then also hit his body, which went up. So,
very sad. Or Murphy, indeed. All righty. Well, at any rate, so I am Wolvomuse on mastodon.social, which is, you know, sort of the original site, because I don't really know anybody who has their own instance. Or if I do, I forgot. So I just signed up there. It was easy. The app, there's an app for iOS and an app for Android and web interface for everything else. So it's okay. All right. And speaking of months and months of waiting for actually something. So Google VPN, which was an add-on subscription service, or it was free if you had like the Google One 2 terabyte tier, is now free for everything, including my El Cheapo $20 a year Google One account, which gives me 100 extra gigabytes plus, you know, some other nice features. Mm-hmm. So Google VPN is now part of the $20 a year tier, and as well as every other tier. So it's been available for a couple of weeks now, I think maybe 1 or 2 weeks, maybe more. And I finally took it for a spin. Really easy to set up if you've already logged into Google on, you know, one of your mobile devices, iPad or Android, because there's no separate login. And Google does have two-factor authentication these days, so it's relatively secure, I would guess, in terms of authentication and all of that. So I took it for a spin, and I gave it a little test. I tested it against NordVPN, which costs, you know, more than $20 a year. And I'm sort of debating whether or not it's something that I can do away with to save a few of my retiree dollars. So it was sort of interesting. So I took it for a spin on a Wi-Fi 5 802.11.ac network. Well, I was sitting outside, actually, so. Without any VPN, I was getting about 330 megabits down and a 19.7, let's call it 20 up. So 330 down, 20 up with no VPN turned on. With NordVPN turned on, I was getting about just shy of 43 down and 11 up. And with Google VPN turned on, I was getting about 25 down, 16 up. So in either case, the VPN really slowed down the available downstream speed. Upstream, it wasn't too bad, right? Like I said, I was getting about 20 up, which is what I'm rated for. 20 megabits upstream without a VPN, I was getting 16.4 with Google One, 11 with, well, you know, it's half, so it's not great. But, you know, home is not where I would use it. This was just testing. And so if you're sitting in an airport or a hotel or someplace not home, someplace not secure, or at least you don't feel secure.
Yeah. Physically or electronically.
Digitally,
digitally. If you don't feel physically secure, you should probably leave.
You should probably leave, exactly. But, you know, it's the price is right, you know, for me at least. It's already have a Google One account, and it's $20 a year, so the price is right in any case. I think NordVPN is pretty inexpensive. I think the yearly cost is, I forget, maybe $70 a year, maybe less. I think, but it's not, you know, terribly expensive, but hey, you know what? Every retiree dollar counts. So I'll give it a thought. One thing I did note, two things I noticed actually, which is very strange. Thing number one, it doesn't work on a Google Chromebook. It does work on a Mac or a Windows PC, but not on a Google Chromebook. So that's kind of weird. Thing number two is not exactly weird, but it gives food for thought, is NordVPN and other VPNs, I think Private Internet Access, which you turned me on to many years ago, both allow you to select the VPN server that you're going through the interwebs on. Mm-hmm. Google VPN, Google just figures out, you know, where you are, and it doesn't even tell you which VPN server. Presumably, it's the closest one to you or fastest one to you, but you just don't know. So a lot less information. I think NordVPN provides some other things too, but I think Google covers some of that. Like, if it looks at your email and detects a weak password that's associated with that account that you used with that email, it warns you. But I think Google does the same thing. So I still haven't decided. We'll see. And it's on a family plan, so my family can use Google VPN too.
The one danger I see when Google selects where your exit point mm-hmm. is, more or less, is with geotagging. One of the things now that you'll get a lot is the suspicious login reports from different services saying, hey, your account's been logged into from this IP that we don't recognize.
Right.
And if you know that you decided to have an exit point in, say, Florida, and then the IP comes from Florida, you know, oh, that was me on my VPN.
Right.
But if Google just sort of picks you know, where I'm at in Mississippi, it might pick a Florida node, or it might pick a South Carolina, or it might pick a Texas. I don't know which of those your suspicious logins. I mean, granted, it would probably likely be at a time when I knew I was connected to my VPN and logging into something. But it's still a little bit leery of, because, you know, I think we've all had, if you have two factor established, we've all had those moments where something has, you know, triggered the two factor, usually your own system that, you know, you didn't realize was trying to log in on another computer. And you get one of those pushes where it's, wait a minute, this isn't, I'm not actually trying to log in right now. I'm going to let this one just sort of sit here and not get answered.
Yeah. Two factor. I should note that even though Google VPN doesn't actually tell you where it's, you know, its VPN server is exiting from, I did use, you know, the What Is My IP website, and it reported that my IP was being seen as Mountain View, California, which is not too surprising, right? That's Google headquarters.
Yeah.
At least in the U.S. I don't know what it looks like outside of the U.S. I'd be kind of curious if some people can tell me. My daughter's heading to Japan in a couple of months, so maybe she can test it for me there and tell me what it reports there when she's there. But at any rate, so that is something I'm giving some thought about. By the way, Google Bard actually gives some advice about the pros and cons of using Google VPN versus NordVPN, which I thought was pretty interesting. And it did give some pros for NordVPN that, you know, features that Google VPN doesn't have. So at least Bard was, you know, pretty honest. Now we have to worry about AI being honest, or at least large language models.
Yep.
Or if at least correct, if, you know, honest is too anthropomorphic for you. All righty. Next, speaking of Bard, so just a couple of days ago, Google added coding assist in Bard, a coding plus Google Sheets assist in Bard for functions. So, you know, it lists a couple of things, including I can help you with, let's see, what does it say? It's, you know, C++ and I think Python and JavaScript and stuff, but it doesn't say anything about some of the old stuff. And so I said, well, I'll go and ask it. And so I asked it to give me here's my prompt. My prompt is provide a JCL sample showing how to increase the number of allocated DASD cylinders. Okay, for those who don't speak mainframe, JCL is job control language. It's not really a programming language. It's literally the setup information that you provide to a batch job on a mainframe. You tell it, you know, where the disk drive is and what your account is and all that kind of stuff. And DASD is basically a hard drive. What does it stand for? Direct access? I forget. But a storage drive or something. So basically it's the hard drives, and on the mainframe you have to allocate space before you can use it. And so I asked it to, you know, allocate, show me just a sample. I didn't say how many cylinders or anything, but how many cylinders to allocate on a DASD. And it did a pretty credible job. I also asked Google Bing, which also did a credible job. I will say that Google Bard actually did better in terms of it explained line by line what the JCL meant. And so I don't know how useful it is. Obviously, if you're a systems programmer with a lot of experience, you don't need it. But the problem is, at least in mainframes, there's not a lot of people left to know how to really, you know, run them. Not many systems wizards for mainframe anymore. And I can tell you that is not conjecture, because I have had to, previous to retiring, part of my job was to run the mainframe teams, and we could not find any local expertise. We had to contract out. We had to basically outsource. It's very expensive. There's no young people, and I'm not saying that to be ageist. It's just the way it is. There's just not a lot of young people going into mainframes these days. And, you know, but they're running mission critical stuff. And I had four people pass away in the course of 2 years.
What kind of horrible boss were you?
Well, only one of you reported to me. But,
oh, okay.
Two were contractors, and one was a very senior technical stakeholder in a large project. And Anyway, we had four people pass away, and one of them was not too old. He was in his 50s, but the other were quite aged and obviously not well. And none from COVID, I should note. None of them died from COVID or, you know, just had COVID when they passed away. But at any rate, it's a real serious problem. There are other domain knowledge domains that have a similar problem. I remember years and years ago when I was working on what used to pass as AI in the dark ages. You know, one of the typical examples people gave were locomotive train engineers, diesel train engineers, who actually knew how to fix stuff and diagnose. And there were not many left at that time. I don't know what the case is now, but that was what we were told. And so that was sort of the stereotypical example of, you know, knowledge domain of stuff that needs to keep running, but with just weren't many people left who knew how to do it. So I wonder now, you know, if this is something that could be used to shore up that gap in knowledge. I mean, you know, sometimes we have to throw people in to help support stuff, like when people pass away, and they may have had some exposure to it. In our case, we did. We had several people had exposure to the stuff before the people passed away, and they're able to pass along a lot of knowledge. But you can imagine, John, you know, it's sort of like, okay, you know, you've done this for like a year and a half, maybe, you know, with a very expert person helping you. And now, I'm sorry, you're on your own and you can't speak to this person anymore. So anyway, that was my question. I wrote a little article on geezerviews.com, which is on Medium, that, you know, wonders out loud or aloud about this. And I don't know, I'd be interested to hear what other people think about it, especially with domains where there aren't very many experts left. And, you know, I think some folks might know some of the very specialized skill sets that people just aren't interested in doing anymore because they're not, you know, sexy or exciting. Yeah. The other thing it does, by the way, I think I mentioned, is that it can write functions of Google Sheets. And so I'll post in our blog show notes what Google Bard says it can do to help you with writing Google Sheets functions. I haven't tried that myself, but I can imagine for a lot of people that'd be very, very useful. I think Bing Copilot can do the same thing for Excel. So there you go. If you want to look smart without asking people, you might want to look at Bard or Bing Copilot. But remember, it could be wrong.
Yeah.
You need to test this stuff. They can be wrong. You know, looking at the
Go get your testing mainframe and do everything and development. And then put it to production after you establish that it works.
It's funny. You know, like I said, I asked the mainframe the same JCL question. I mean, mainframe. I asked Bard and Bing the same JCL question. It gave me different JCL. They both look correct. Well, they're samples, so correct is a relative word. They both look reasonable to me. They both point to the same ZOS utility that's needed. So that was, you know, at least in common. But I don't have a mainframe in my house. I don't know about you, John. I just don't.
Got rid of my years ago.
No. I have nothing to test it on, and it's just kind of my vague memory. It's been years since I wrote JCL myself, but at any rate, yeah. And I just one note in our show notes. So this harkens, as I said earlier, this harkens back to my misspent youth when I was looking at preserving and emulating domain-based knowledge using really old technology. This is the 1980s and early 1990s, so over 30 years ago, using rule-based expert systems, which hardly anybody uses anymore. I'm sure they're still out there. But I don't think anybody. But I think a combination of LLM with expert system to, you know, focus the domain, that might be kind of a way to preserve and augment the disappearing knowledge domains. At any rate, that was my thought of the week, and I hope folks are thinking about the same thing. Because boy, I tell you, it is hard to find, and it's very expensive to bring in expert mainframe system programmers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very rare and expensive commodity. Anyway, John, I see you have some stuff in our show notes too. And I don't know.
Well, yeah. So going from the past to the future, or actually you were in the past with the future because you were with AI and mainframes. In 6 weeks from tomorrow, as we record this, Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference kicks off, and there are starting to be some rumors circulating around, or the rumor mill is amping up about what might or might not be announced. And this always makes me interested in sort of, for you and I, as people that use Apple technologies quite a bit,
yep,
what we want to see. Because every year, I'm disappointed, but every year there's at least something interesting that comes out. You know, I think the most interesting thing from last year was probably the lock screen changes in iOS. Those are kind of nice. The multiple lock screens and focus being able to change. Although that's kind of a neat feature. Still don't think it's as built out as it could be, but who knows? We'll see if we get some evolution on that. But it got me thinking a little bit about what I actually want to see. And I figured I'd run down my list of what I would like to see, and then you can chime in on anything you'd like. So the first, we've heard a lot about this AR-VR headset that Apple is developing. Sort of, it reminds me very much of the run-up to the Apple Watch. Because in the 3 or 4 years before the Apple Watch was announced, it was a very poorly kept secret that Apple was working on a watch. And at the time, the most, well-known smartwatch on the market was the Pebble.
Which you had.
People sort of argue, well, nobody's even using Pebble, so it's useless for Apple to go do this. I think it was shown to be wrong. And right now, there's a lot of people saying Apple should not be doing an AR-VR headset. It's not ready yet. There's been rumors that internally it's not quite ready and that Tim Cook is like, no, we're going forward with it.
Yeah.
Well, who knows what if that's true or not. I would just like an AR-VR headset I actually want to use. And for that, it has to do more than just gaming, which seems to be the only space that AR-VR really is in right now. I'd like to see AR useful in daily life. There's been some fitness discussion about if you had an AR headset while you were out running or walking or playing a sport, it would be really cool to be able to see your metrics and all that on a heads-up display without having to look down at your watch and potentially run into something. I don't care what Apple does with it. I just want an AR/VR headset I could actually want to use for something.
I would add, I would want one I can afford. If it's $2,000 or $3,000, that's out of the question for me.
Yeah, and that is the big unknown, because the price estimates have been all over the place. Of course, the Apple Watch, the price estimates were all over the place. Some people thought it was going to be under $100, kind of an iPod Shuffle or iPod Nano, Apple Watch version. Others were saying, no, it's going to be as much as a MacBook. It's going to be $2,000 to $3,000, and no one's going to buy it. Obviously, it was somewhere in between that. Of course,
there were a few $1,000 ones originally. The super expensive ones. I forget what it was called, but
the Apple Watch Edition.
Yeah.
One that was $2,000 or $3,000. So, yeah, you're right. Price is going to be, I've already thought if it looks interesting enough and it's reasonable, I will probably buy one. But I don't know. It's the same thing with some other big ticket things where I've been back and forth many times on. But would you see any use scenarios that you would want AR VR for, assuming it was reasonable? And
well, you know, I think what you said originally, what it can already do, basically for entertainment, might be interesting, to watch a movie or something. But quite frankly, there are headsets available now that aren't too terribly expensive. I would consider them affordable even to a poor retiree like myself. But I still haven't bought them because I just, would I really use them? You know, there's a lot of gadgets I've bought over, and maybe it's because I'm just old, but there's a lot of gadgets I bought over the years that I never used. You know, it's fun. Speaking of which, John, as you know, I've been going through my Swedish death cleaning, and I just found a bunch of headsets I never used. I mean, not VR headsets, but, just audio headsets, like a Microsoft Sidewinder. That was never even open. It was literally sitting in a box. And the foam earpieces had melted so badly that melted onto the headset itself. So it wasn't even worth changing the foam around it to see if it was still usable, which it probably wasn't, because it needed drivers and, mini 2.5 millimeter earphone sockets that nobody has anymore. So, but it was I just found so many things like that. I never used this at all. That was a waste. Yeah.
Well, sometimes you do find that you buy something with the best of intentions, like the Pi, and you end up not particularly.
I know. That's something I gotta, that's one of my goals this week, is to open it up and at least update Raspberry Pi OS to see where. I think I updated it right after I retired, so it shouldn't be too bad. But as you know, Linux tends to be a fast-moving object to chase. Yeah, I'm really afraid it's going to... The other one is not Apple, but, you know, Google's rumored folding Pixel phone, which sounds fascinating, but the rumored price, I think, is like $1,700 to $2,000, and that's just way too much.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is, again, non-Apple, but the Google Pixel tablet. And I say that because, if Apple has something like that, I'd find it interesting. Not a tablet. They obviously have an iPad. But what I was going to say is my Lenovo Smart Display, 10-inch Smart Display, which, you know, is a Google Assistant. Google decided that the third-party stuff is all going to be end of life. They're not going to support it anymore for security and whatever. And I'm not even sure if what that means. If that means that it's going to like shut off after support is pulled. You know, is it still going to work?
Mm-hmm.
And I use it every day. You know, it's really super handy. And the other thing is that my Amazon Echo Show 5, which I use as an alarm clock and all kinds, it's got a 5-inch display. It's really useful. It's not that old, but the screen is flickering. And so, you know, I think it's going out too. So my two smart assistants are both looking at end of life situations. You know, they're going to go into some kind of hospice care or something. But
yeah, that is somewhat, it's just a very frustrating world with end of life. With certain manufacturers. And that is one thing that, you know, as much as people bag on Apple, I will say at least the Apple products tend to have fairly long lifespans.
Yeah.
Compared to the rest of the tech universe.
Yeah.
As I think about some of the stuff I have, of course, you know, the technology I have that's sitting around actually works just as well today as it did when I first bought it was the original Samsung Galaxy Tab 2010. Yeah. It's been my faithful digital picture frame in my living room since about 2013. Wow. And it's still kicking. It still turns on, still shows pictures. It's running.
Mine died. Mine died, as well as whatever the first... What was the first Google tablet? Wasn't it?
It was a Google... It was a Nexus 7.
Nexus 7, yeah. That died a horrible death, too, so... Those did not last nearly as long as my iPad minis and iPads and so forth. But yeah, definitely. Apple's hardware generally is rock solid and long lasting. Basically, the hardware will probably outlive the supported OS, which is usually 5-6 years at a minimum for middle devices.
It's really interesting how for a long time people complained about Apple with, you know, don't upgrade it because it'll get too slow, it won't work right, blah, blah, blah. And so sort of around the time of iOS 7 or 8, Apple fixed that. And it became, you know, they didn't brick it after, and yet there's still the reputation of it. But ironically, I would have thought that when they did that and they said, you know, you can still run 4 or 5 year old hardware with, you know, fairly modern software, that would have made the industry move along. And that's one thing that Google and Samsung have not copied off of Apple.
Yeah.
It's more like, no, we want people buying new things every year or two. We don't want them holding out to things. Which is a strategic decision, I'm sure.
Yeah. You know, and I should note, speaking of Apple support, and I'm a huge fan of their support, really. I still have an iPad Mini 4, as well as iPad Mini 6. And the iPad Mini 4, which is 7 years old, I mean, it's pretty old. iPad Mini 4 cannot be upgraded to iPad OS 16. I think it maxes out at 15 point something. I noticed the other day that Apple issued a security patch for it, like a 15.7 point, you know, X. So even though it is not getting 16 ever, which is fine, I mean, it's pretty darn old. They did issue a security patch. So if you've still got an iPad Mini 4, you know, go check the About box and see what version you're running and then do a software update, because you might be surprised there's a security patch waiting there for you. So,
very good.
Yeah, kudos to Apple for continuing to support really old hardware that still works, at least for me.
So a few other things that I'm hoping to see. This one has been a long request from a lot of people that use Apple Watch, and that is rest days. Aura, the company I have that makes the Aura ring, they actually do this very well, where they go, hey, you know, your activity looks a little
sketchy and you look like you might be sick, maybe you should take a few days off. We'll suspend all of your goals. We'll basically
really?
Give you some time. And then once you turn off rest mode, and over a couple of days, it ramps you back up your normal levels of activity and your goal tracking and all of that. Apple does not. If you break a streak, it's broken. And there's no way to say, hey, I was sick. Can't I have a give me? The only thing you can do is set your activity and all of your goals ridiculously low for a few days, which is a viable thing. If you know that, hey, I'm not going to be up doing a bunch of stuff hourly, so I need to go from my normal 500 calorie move goal to a 100 calorie move goal, Apple will let you do that. And you'll still preserve your streaks and all that. But it would be nice for Apple to acknowledge that sometimes you're sick or sometimes you're on vacation. And sometimes you don't want to be tracking your goals in the same way. Of course, technically these things don't mean anything, so you could just ignore them.
Right, right. But some people are very, what's the word I want to use that's not, doesn't have bad value judgments. Some people are very tenacious in their thinking about how things should
be. Tenacious. Diligent, persnickety, anal retentive. I mean, depending on exactly what you would like to use for it. Particular, zealot, I don't know, whatever you want. Similarly, with Apple Watch, they integrated last year the ability to custom workout routines, which is a really nice feature. I have a few that I put together. The problem is you have to create them on the watch. So while watch is not a bad interface, for example, one of the things I have is a ladder run workout, which basically starts with a 5-minute thing of work and then a 1-minute rest and then 4 minutes and then 1 minute, then 3 minutes and 1 minute, 2 minutes and 1 minute, 1 minute, 1 minute. That takes a while to put in because it's not an easy repeat. Whereas if it was 5 and 1, 5 and 1, 5 and 1, that you can't actually put a repeat loop in. So the ability to edit those custom workouts on an iPhone or a Mac would be kind of nice to be able to build it out there and have it sync up to the watch. Kind of the ability to build certain things out and sync them to the watch on an iPhone or a Mac would be nice just in general. You know, slideshows and custom watch faces, which, again, I've been wanting 2015 custom watch faces. I don't think we're going to get them anytime soon. Third-party access to watch faces or your ability to code your own.
Yeah,
and it doesn't definitely. Like Apple's in any hurry to ever add that in.
Yeah, and it's funny. There's not a big outcry for it either. People seem pretty happy with the available watch faces.
You can get about 95% of the place you want to go with custom. You just can't get all the way.
Right.
A couple of things that only maybe I care about, the ability to hook Siri up to whatever else I want. So Siri to ChatGPT or
Bing. Yeah.
In theory works, but I've never been able to get it successfully work. But really, just open Siri up. You're not going to build out Siri, Apple. We know that. You haven't, for many years, built out Siri. So just open it up to third party in some way, more than it is now. It really, the third party integrations are not great for Siri.
Right. Give Siri some help.
Yes. And last thing, and this is a weird one. Again, this is probably like the 8th year in a row where they're saying macOS is just going to be a quality of life upgrade. It's not going to be anything new and unique, which is boring and stupid. I want something exciting in macOS. But, you know, I use Apple first-party tools quite a bit just because I'm curious what that life is like. For many years, I bounced back and forth between Outlook and Apple Mail, I've been on Apple Mail again for about a year and a half now. There's some integration there that Apple could do much better, which is weird because Apple usually is all about integration.
Right.
But have you ever tried to create a reminder in Apple Reminders from an email in Apple Mail?
No, I don't even use Apple Mail.
Okay. This is the stupidest integration ever. You have to select text on the subject line of the email.
Okay.
So select the subject line, right-click on it, and choose Share, and then Share to Reminders. It pops up the share sheet where it goes, you know, what list do you want it on reminders?
Right.
What, you know, what due date, all that. You hit Add. And then in Reminders, you will actually see a little email icon next to that reminder to show that it was created from Apple Mail. And if you click on that email icon, it will open the email message in Apple Mail to show you, oh, this was the message that you wanted to be reminded about. So that's exactly the behavior I want. I like this idea that it will link the mail item to reminders.
Right.
That seems like a no-brainer. You could do that with Outlook 20 years ago by just dragging an email item onto the reminder tab, and it would add the email into the reminder text. But yeah, if you screw it up just a little bit, you don't get that. Okay. So if you don't select the subject line, or you don't, you know, get the share sheet just right,
right,
it doesn't work.
That sounds too complicated.
So, yeah, exactly. For a company that's all about integrations, make logical integrations between your first-party apps more so than these weird archaic summoning spells that you now have to do in order to get the right linking to go. So that's my request, that there's more integration between the core, what we used to refer to as PIM, personal information management apps, you know, reminders, email, note, calendar, contact, integrate those a little bit better in macOS would be nice.
You know, it's funny. I have not used a native app email client personally in years because Outlook was just such a bear to use. Especially every time I moved computers, I had to reconfigure the, you know, SMTP and the IMAP 4 and sometimes POP 3. And it was just like, oh, forget it. I'll just use a web interface for everything. The only place I use a fat mail client was when I was working. And that was Outlook. But that made sense because Outlook for web was okay. But it wasn't quite fully featured to me or for me as the fat client. But except for work, I can't remember the last time I used a fat client on purpose, you know.
Used a fat client for purpose. That just sounds like that you're talking about something innuendo-wise versus but, what you're actually talking about.
But, yeah, I just can't, you know, Outlook is just a terrible experience on a personal machine. It's not so bad if you had an Exchange server and, you know, you could quickly configure things, but to do the multiple, like I said, multiple IMAP 4s or POP 3s or SMTPs and, you know, all that stuff and poking holes through a firewall sometimes. And it was just an unpleasant experience. And I just didn't like it. And I gave up as soon as I could switch as much as I could to web-based email, which was years and years and years and years ago, probably when Gmail came out. But I do remember buying a whole bunch of third-party email clients. And I also used Mozilla Thunderbird for a while.
Oh yeah,
but that was dropped.
I have used Thunderbird. I've used it for mail archiving in the past. Yeah,
Thunderbird is a whole different project now, you know. I forget what it is. Let's see. Thunder, I mean, you know, not the Thunderbird. Is it still Thunderbird Mozilla? Is it not something else now, or is it still an email client? Well, I guess it's still an email client. Initial release date 2003. Preview release date, there's a 112 beta that was released last month. So it's still around. I thought the project was killed, but apparently not. So there you go. Mozilla Thunderbird is still around. I have no interest in using it anymore. Well, why do you like to use a fat client for email?
That's a good question. I don't know. I enjoy using something that is faster, and web apps are just always a little bit slower than native, in my opinion.
Interesting. I guess I'm so used to it now that I don't even see them as slow, you know, except for certain functions, like when I'm trying to do mass filtering and deletions, it's probably faster on a fat client. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's one of part of the digital aspect of my Swedish death cleaning is to try to clean up all the mail I've let accumulate in Gmail over the last, you know, however long it's been around, 15 years or whatever. I think I have like 40,000 email messages. A lot of it is, you know, marketing stuff that I just never deleted. Going through it now, it's kind of fun.
Well, don't worry. Eventually, you'll get all those Swedes out of your house. You know, get all the dead ones, the live ones, they'll all just be.
By the way, one thing I just read about this morning, or at least one rumor I read about this morning related to WWDC, is that there is a rumored iOS 17 journal app or journaling app.
Yeah, I saw
it's reported in a couple of places. I mean, Wall Street Journal is reporting it. Verge is reporting it. Ars Technica on 95 Mac. So, you know, wherever that original rumor came from, it seems to have traction.
Yeah.
Codename Jurassic.
Yeah, I'd argue that it would be basically the, I suppose, ripoff of Day One, the journaling app that I've used for a number of years. So I'll be very curious to see if that is the case or not.
Yeah. Maybe it's going to be tied to their AR-VR thing, you know. They'll have a camera to record you. And
quite possible.
Yeah.
So do you have anything that you're hoping for or wanting from this next iteration of iOS, macOS, Apple Watch OS?
Well, one thing I'm the only one who wants it is, you know, I've got this, I've mentioned it to you before, I've got this weird certificate that we somehow picked up during the MVP days, MVP Summit days, like over a decade ago, that keeps popping up telling me that the cert has expired and I can't delete it from my iPhone or iPad or anything else that it says promulgated to over the years, because, you know, I can't. And the problem is, of course, and it's my fault, is that I do not build new iOS, iPadOS devices from scratch. I always restore from a backup and start from there. I guess the way to fix it is to stop doing that when I upgrade to my next iDevice, and that'll fix it, and just manually reinstall everything. But it's such a hassle, you know, to reinstall everything. And some apps don't store their data in the cloud, like my drawing apps. And so if I want to bring everything with me, the only way to do it is to restore from backup. And I can't just restore one app and its data. So any rate, I guess I'll just have to say, well, you know what? Just bite the bullet, so to speak. So that's a weird thing, but I'll figure it out. Oh, I guess that's the other thing that would solve it, is if all apps could store their data in a common place that could be restored on a freshly created device, you know, versus restoring from a full backup. That's what I would like, incremental restoration of a new device. Other than that, I'd like Stage Manager to work a little bit more naturally. It just seems still artificial, you know, like the external display on the M1, M2-based devices. You got to have a keyboard and mouse attached, or at least a keyboard, I think. You can't have an external display without a, you know, physical input device. That would be nice to have. I wish that iPadOS Stage Manager would let me reroute audio like I want it. So the other thing it does is, if you're using Stage Manager with an external display with an HDMI cable, and your HDMI display does not have speakers, your audio is still routed to it, and you have no audio while you're using Stage Manager with an external display. So I'd like that. I guess it's not new features. I'd like them to fix what they got. So maybe that goes along with, you know, what they're saying about what iPad or, you know, iOS, iPadOS 17 is going to be. I'd like Freeform to be more understandable to human beings. To me, it's still, I don't get it. I don't have a good model in my head on how to use it. And I don't see a lot of people really talking about Freeform anymore after its release.
I know.
I wish Freeform would just get a web view.
Yes.
But we've talked about that before.
Yes, absolutely. And one thing, I guess it's not what I wish, as I just noted, you know, when Apple Music Classical came out a month ago, one of the things I noted is that you could not, if you create a playlist, you couldn't download it. But what I found is, if you create a playlist in Apple Music Classical, it can be downloaded to Apple Music. And in fact, it shows up as just a normal playlist in Apple Music. So if you created a Apple Music Classical playlist and you want to listen when you're driving or on an airplane or train or whatever, you can still do that. Just bring it down to Apple Music. So although that, you know, for the more refined people out there, that might not be sufficient because they want to have their notes and all of that. But for people like me, and I should note that my Apple Music Classical, the only playlist I've created so far, is called Looney Tunes, because it's made up of classical music that was used in Looney Tunes, you know, Bugs Bunny.
I might have to ask you for a screenshot of that playlist.
Sure, share my playlist, apparently, but maybe I can do it from Apple Music. I'll see if I can share it from Apple Music.
I'll just see if I can follow you. That is one of the most well-hidden features in Apple Music, is that you can follow people and see their publicly shared playlists, but for the life of me, half the time I can't find people on there.
Yeah. Well, I will try to share them. I'll make it public, because, you know, I'm not proud. proud that, you know, I'm lowbrow. It's fine. It's fine. Mr. Bun is out there making a lot of noise. Yes. Can I make this? I will see if I can make this public now. How do I make this public? Share playlist.
So this is how stupid this interface is. I'm on Listen Now in Apple Music, and I'm looking for who I follow, and I can find who I'm recommended to follow, but I had to go to my own profile to see who I am following. And now I'm trying to find you, and you are not in my recommended friends, even though half these people I know. In fact, ironically, because I know Sal, because I follow him on Apple Music, I see a lot of his friends, but I don't see you. So, yeah, I've just added your playlist to my Apple Music since you sent me the link directly.
Yep.
Apple does not want us to fight each other.
They do not want us to be friends. Yes. No. And one of the things I learned, by the way, is at least amongst the ones I could find, is that Johann Strauss, too, is apparently heavily used by Looney Tunes in their cartoons. Because there's a whole bunch. It's pretty interesting, actually. So, Voices of Spring, The Waltz, you know, Tales from the Vienna Woods, Blue Danube, you'll recognize it as soon as you see it. Or hear it, I should say. And it's really funny to listen to this playlist, if you're a fan of Looney Tunes as I am. Because although, you know, the classical musician types or classical enthusiasts would recognize it for what they are, you know what, because they're simply very famous pieces on their own, the rest of us will say, oh yes, I remember that from Bugs Bunny, you know, or Daffy Duck or whatever.
In the spirit of sending playlists to people, I will send you the link to the playlist that I use when I am hungry and my wife can't decide what we should do for food. And it's the John's I'm Hungry Damn It playlist. These are all songs that if you would like to passive aggressively send a message to someone that you're hungry and that they should give you food. We start off with Hungry Like the Wolf by Duran Duran. We go with Hungry Eyes by Eric Carmen, Breakfast at Tiffany's, Chicken Fried, Raspberry Beret, Cheeseburger Paradise, Banana Pancakes, Brown Sugar, American Pie, Cherry Pie, Watermelon Crawl, Fruit Cakes, Pour Some Sugar on Me, Coconut, and Candy Shop. So if someone's listening to these and they do not get the message, you should just go eat without them.
I got it. I also like the little thumbnail that you have associated with it.
Yes.
What is that hat you're wearing, by the way? Is that associated with hunker? No, that looks like okra. I also say it looks like a fighting okra. All
right. Well, I should not.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, just say I had to share the classical, Apple Music classical playlist with John through Apple Music, because I don't think you can share it through classical. But anyway, go ahead.
Yes, that would be too easy. So the final thing I have, this is my mini rant. I don't know if you've ever had to do this. Have you ever had to calculate durations of time in Excel?
Yes.
So, you know, 2 minutes and 50 seconds plus 3 minutes and 25 seconds.
Right.
Yeah. It is a pain in Excel. Excel does not have a default duration date format. And you can do it if you go into custom, and there's a link I'll put in our show notes that is one blog's way of discussing it. But I don't know why there isn't just a data format for duration.
There is.
Not in Excel on a Mac.
Really?
There's date and time functions, and then there's a custom function.
Okay, so there's... Okay, so I'll have to go back and check. But I thought it worked in Excel. It definitely works in Google Sheets, because I do it for our podcast all the time.
Sheets has a default duration, but if you go into time on format cells, and I can pull up Windows and look at the Windows version of Excel.
I'll go look at it, too.
It only wants you to be doing things unless you go into custom, and custom is where you do this in Excel, but it still never works right for me on at least Mac. It's boggling to me that there isn't a custom duration period, whereas Numbers and Google Sheets has just as a drop-down data type.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact,
this is just a weird one that I've never noticed.
In Google Sheets, you don't even have to use a function. It just knows the type from the format. So you type hour, colon, minute, colon, seconds. And if you want down to, you know, milliseconds with a period after the seconds, and you can just use it as a calculation format without equals function, anything like that. It's pretty sweet and simple. I thought they'd work like that in Excel too, but I'd have to go back.
So I'm going to test something in Excel because I'm pretty sure in Excel, if you put in 5:00, it thinks that's 5 a.m.
Yeah.
But I'm curious if I put it 5:00:02, so minute, hour, second, what it thinks. And it thinks that that's 5:00:02 a.m.
Okay.
So that's obviously not right because I don't care to get my minutes down to the millisecond, or actually, I think a millisecond, like centisecond or something like that. So let me go into, I've got my Windows VM open here. I'll think if I can get into Excel quick enough here and see if the Windows version of Excel at least has what I would expect. But the Mac version is not helpful. 5:00:02 should not be 5 a.m. and 2 seconds. It should be 5:00:02, in my opinion. Let's see. In the Windows version, if you type 5, oh, I don't want to try your new look. Why this go 5:00:02? And I don't want you to tell me I'm all set because I have Office or Microsoft 365. I already knew that. Yeah, it does the same thing in the Windows version. It defaults 5:00:02 to be 5 a.m., 0 minutes, and 2 seconds.
Well, I have just paid for my annual Office 365 subscription renewal, so I will download. You know, I have not used a FAT client, Office FAT client, again, I think, since I retired. Even though I have a personal account, like I said, and I just renewed my personal account. So I guess I have all my all 5 or 6 licenses available, however many there are. I just use the web interface for everything, but I will try it. Alrighty.
This is just my ranting then.
Yep. Alrighty then. This has been Mobile Podcast 457. Went quite a bit. I didn't think we would talk more than 20 minutes. We're coming up
to the top
of the hour. Alrighty. We will talk to you next time.